Have you ever thought of quitting Facebook? Coming up on Central Standard, author Andrew Keen, who's been called the Antichrist of Silicon Valley, explains that on top of painful oversharing that can happen on social media platforms, he believes that Facebook is continually taking advantage of us.
It's not because they're bad people. It's their business model is flawed. Free is never really free. Consumers think they're really well off, in which because they have a free search engine like Google or a free network like Facebook. But they're never really free. These are not public services. They're built on acquiring our data and then selling that data one way or the other to advertisers. So if you want to be exploited, use these networks.
I'm Jabalani LaFall, and we'll hear why our guest says quitting Facebook was one of the best things he's ever done online. That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. The term vertigo has a Latin origin, and it denotes a whirling or spinning movement. Vertigo is also a condition of dizziness, a common complaint among many a hospital patient. Our guest today has a new diagnosis for vertigo, as our increasingly social and mobile internet lifestyle has likewise whirled and spun into our lives. Digital vertigo has now become a mainstay. And joining us now is Andrew Keen, author of the book Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. Andrew Keen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell us about your book and what made you decide to write it.
Well, the book is actually built around Alfred Hitchcock's movie, Vertigo, and it's based on the idea that we've fallen in love with something that doesn't really exist. We've fallen in love with the idea of social media that is supposed to bring us together, Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Foursquare and all these other hot new Silicon Valley inventions. But I argue in the book that the more we use them, the lonelier we become, the more distracted, the more dispersed, the more atomized and alienated. So like in Hitchcock's movie Vertigo, we've fallen in love with an illusion, a delusion, and we end our infatuation with social media poorer and more disillusioned.
And you make a pretty contrarian point in your book, but why digital vertigo? The definition, as I mentioned, is making you dizzy or disoriented. Have our online options made us dizzy as thinkers or as citizens?
Absolutely. I think this technology is dizzying in every respect. It's real time. In fact, now some people are talking about it as being faster than real time. Every second, every millisecond, there's a new tweet, a new Facebook update. It's harder and harder for us to understand what's going on. It's harder and harder for us to concentrate. We're living in a 140 character culture, which means that we can't concentrate. We can't think about things in depth. And we're continually defining ourselves, not in terms of our inner selves, but in terms of others, which adds to the dizzying quality of this social media culture.
You mentioned us living in a 140 character culture. One of the centerpieces of the personal experiences outlined in your book is your relationship to Twitter. Tell us about that. And you also have your Twitter handle, AJ Keen, at AJ Keen, ironically, on your book cover. So tell us about your relationship with Twitter, even as you deride the social media movement.
Well, my narrative, I think, is ambivalent about Twitter. I recognize, and I think this is part of my criticism, it's all very well to say it's dizzying and problematic and destructive in many ways, but it's also necessary. And I acknowledge that in my own relationship with Twitter as a writer that I have to be on it, that it's my way of reaching a public, of broadcasting. So the challenge in the future is not to give this stuff up. I'm not a Luddite. I'm not saying we should do without. I'm not telling people to trash their iPhones or put away their computers or their iPads or their tablets. What I am saying is that as we live more and more publicly, we need to be able to figure out a way of maintaining our uniqueness of as human beings in a culture of increasing publicness and this dizzying quality of social media. So my own ambivalent relationship with Twitter, I'm guessing, is probably similar to many of your listeners. Many of your listeners are on LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter. They need it. They need to build their brands, to distribute their wisdom, to build their networks and relationships. And yet at the same time, they're very uncomfortable with the idea that everything about them is known. More and more people now are living with these location networks, which tell the world where you are. Do we really want to do that? Maybe it's necessary, but at the same time, the core theme in my book is that we're losing something essential as human beings, the mystery, the secrecy that has historically defined us as unique beings and as interesting beings and as meaningful and rich beings. I end my book in Amsterdam. I'm looking at a famous painting by Johannes Vermeer called The Woman in Blue, which is a painting of the inner life. That's what I fear we're losing in our digital vertigo culture.
You speak of fear of losing the inner life. You mentioned getting off Facebook because you were embarrassed by the things that people put on there, or said you were embarrassed by the things that people put on there. What embarrassed you particularly about Facebook?
Well, it's interesting. A lot of people have tried to generationalize this debate and say, oh, it's the young people. They've lost their sense of privacy. We older people are wiser, more experienced. We know what we're doing. I think that's the wrong way of thinking about this. I actually got deeply disillusioned with Facebook because what I saw was a number of my friends or people I didn't know very well who were posting and pasting huge amounts of information about their children, sometimes about their infants. And it made me very, very uncomfortable the way in which this publicness had become a kind of de facto feature of our culture. And parents, often responsible, respectable, smart, caring parents, are plastering the world, plastering this new platform for how we're living our life with photos of their kids. And they're not even asking their kids, what happens when these kids grow up? And they see photos of themselves as infants and as teenagers plastered over the network by their parents. So after a while, it embarrassed and angered me, and I left it. So I am a Facebook refusenik. I'm someone who left Facebook. But it's easy for me, of course, to leave Facebook because that's part of my brand. It's harder for most people. I'm not saying Facebook's all bad. For the grandmother who networks with their grandchildren on Facebook, for some of us who have moved from our childhood homes and are able to reconnect with childhood friends, it's still a good network. I just think we need to know where to draw the line.
Yeah, I'm currently on a Facebook fast myself. Had to just kind of cut it out.
Oh, good.
Kind of cut it out.
Join the club.
Yeah, cut it out.
Congratulations. I bet you feel better about it.
A little bit. How have your friends reacted, though, to you not being on Facebook? Some of the people in my immediate circle and in my life kind of feel, you know, almost an affront, like, you know, where you been? And I'm like, right here. But how do your friends feel about your ambivalence towards Facebook, or your aversion to Facebook, rather?
Well, I don't have any friends. No, I'm joking. No, my real friends are people who I telephone with, who I meet with. I'm lucky enough that I do a lot of traveling as an author and a public speaker. So even though I was born in Europe and I live in the U.S., I'm able to see them. I don't think anyone was in any way offended. I mean, I think it's also because it's part of my brand as a critic. I mean, people joke about me as the Antichrist of Silicon Valley. So
wow.
It would almost be odd if I didn't leave Facebook. And my first book, Cult of the Amateur, which was very critical of the blogosphere and of blogging, I had my own blog. And always in these sorts of interviews, the first question was, well, you're against blogging and yet you have your own blog. So I wasn't going to fall into that trap with Facebook. If I'm going to write a book against Facebook, I think the very minimum I can do to maintain my credibility is not being on it.
It's interesting that you bring up your book, Cult of the Amateur, which preceded this book, Digital Vertigo. Around that central premise is the idea that the internet undermines the authority of learned experts and the work of professionals, and quite simply asserts that there are too many people blogging and talking. Do you feel that way? You particularly, you know, went in against Wikipedia, YouTube, Reddit, Digit, and a lot of the social media mainstays that are user generated. Talk about that.
Well, in 2007, I wrote a book called Cult of the Amateur, which was very controversial at the time because it suggested that in this cacophony of self-generated user content, user-generated content, we're losing the value of curated professional musicians, writers, filmmakers. And at the time when the book came out, it was, I wouldn't say universally derided, but the majority of people, particularly on the internet, argued I was an elitist and that I didn't understand what was happening and that a new business model would evolve for writers and musicians and filmmakers. But the reality is that that hasn't happened. Very, very few bloggers have turned into professional journalists. Very few people who self-publish their books on the internet have been able to make a living. So if we see this catastrophic decline in mainstream media, whether it's the closing of newspapers or the crisis of the music industry, it's harder and harder to make a living as a professional creative artist. And that really worries me because I want my writers and musicians to be able to spend their day concentrating on their work rather than having to wait tables in the day and then focus on their work in the evening. And I think that this vast, supposedly democratized internet hasn't produced that much culture. And when it comes to social media, of course, we have more and more of a cacophony. The more people put tweets up, the more they post on Facebook and LinkedIn and all these other networks, the less time they have to read, the less time they have to go to the movie theater, the less time they have to buy CDs, which is, again, one of the reasons why professional curators, professional content makers are in such crisis.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM and streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're joined today by Andrew Keen, author of Digital Vertigo. David Foster Wallace famously said 99% of the internet is, you know, an expletive crap, basically is what he was saying, and that the other 1% would need to be gatekeepers. What do you think about the idea of a more institutional curation of this content? And how will that evolve?
That's the great question. That's it's not the million, no, it's the billion or the several billion dollar question that everybody's still trying to figure out. Back in 2007, when I wrote my book, Cult of the Amateur, everyone said, oh, well, we'll figure out a business model. Don't worry. We'll figure out a way to pay curators. But curators are the real value, whether it's a newspaper editor deciding what's on the front page, whether it's a book publisher deciding which manuscripts they should publish. And we still haven't figured out a way to reinvent curation in the digital age. We can't go back to the old world. I'm not saying that. I'm not really nostalgic. And in some ways, you're bound to have a caller who will say, oh, well, old media was elitist and wrong, and it published a lot of rubbish, and a lot of newspapers are biased, and the stuff that comes out of Hollywood is bad. And in some ways, there's some truth to that. But look at what the internet has wrought. Not that much more value. If all we've got out of the internet is the Huffington Post, and I'd rather have the New York Times.
You say the endless temptation to broadcast ourselves intimately and globally to the world is ruining us. How is it ruining us?
When I say ruining us, what I mean, I think, and particularly in terms of digital vertigo, is I think it's taking away from our humanness, our color, our mystery, our secrecy, what makes us human. When you think about yourself, how did you acquire your personality? How did you become who you are? We all know that that is the core achievement in our lives. That's what makes us who we are. That's what gives our life meaning. And when you have now generations of people who are living so publicly, who are telling the world everything about themselves, I fear that we're being ruined because we are not giving ourselves the space, the dark space, that closed room, that enclosed space that nobody else sees, to build who we are. The more public we become, the thinner we are conceptually, the more transparent. There's this kind of ideology of what I call radical transparency. Everyone in Silicon Valley is always saying, oh, radical transparency is good. The TED conference even just put on a global event in Edinburgh called Radical Transparency. I think the more radically transparent we are, the less interesting we are as human beings, the more like robots, the more like aggregations of data we become. So you're welcome to live in a radically transparent world, but it's not good for us as a species.
What would you say, though, to the argument that this radical transparency gives each individual the right and the forum to express the identity that they've garnered thus far through a global means? Gives them a voice for the first time. Some people are given a voice for the very first time in their lives. What would you say to that argument along those lines?
Well, Sheryl Sandberg, who makes the trains run on time in Facebook, she's the number two to Mark Zuckerberg, in an article last year for The Economist, wrote that Facebook enables us to become authentic. So she's making the argument that you just made. Now, my response would be to that is that that's absurd, because it suggests that we couldn't be authentic before Facebook. This idea that only by broadcasting ourselves, telling the world what music we like, where we are, what we want to do, what we're eating, where we're flying to, that enables authenticity is absurd. We were equally authentic before Facebook. Just go and look at the paintings of Johannes Vermeer and the rich inner life of his subjects. Now, I would acknowledge in political terms that networks like Facebook and Twitter have enabled a degree of democratization which didn't exist, particularly in the Middle East. I acknowledge that, although I have some problems with the consequences of that. It don't seem to be maturing into viable political organizations. But I do think you have to distinguish between these platforms as enablers of democracy to ones in which somehow enable us as individuals to become authentic, because we were just as authentic, in fact, in some ways more authentic before the invention of electronic media, before the internet, than we are today.
What makes us then less authentic if we're saying what music we like, or we're saying what books we like, or we're saying where our favorite hot dog stand is? How is that less authentic as opposed to just giving more people
like
more
this
information?
Yeah, I mean, you introduced the word authenticity. I think anyone who uses the word authenticity is by definition inauthentic. And again, it's no coincidence that people like Sandberg and Arianna Huffington are the ones peddling this term. I'm not entirely sure what it means. But I certainly don't, whether it makes us more authentic isn't really the issue. It certainly doesn't make us less authentic. If you're sitting around a kitchen table and talking to your family or your friends, if you're sitting in a bar or a pub or a restaurant or in a town somewhere, you are equally authentic. If not, I think in many ways one could argue more authentic if you acknowledge the notion of this word than if you're simply broadcasting yourself to millions of people on the internet who you don't know, who you'll never know. I don't accept this idea that by being able to broadcast ourselves to a global audience, that makes us more authentic, that it makes us truer. Authenticity is about truth. As human beings, I don't think it makes us any truer. It just gives us more reach. Although the reality is that most people are entirely disinterested in what we're saying.
I'm going to get a little cheeky here. What if you put your kitchen table family gathering on YouTube? Then how does that change the equation? You're being authentic in the pub or at the kitchen table, and you put it on YouTube just because it was an interesting conversation. How does that change the equation?
It's not cheeky. It's an interesting point. What would that do, though? So you have a meaningful conversation around the dinner table with your most intimate friends and family. And then I don't know whether they would know it or not. It would probably be unknowing. And you film that, and then you put it up on YouTube for the world to see. Firstly, it doesn't make the conversation any more authentic. But I think it cheapens it. It would embarrass it. If I was part of that in a group, I would be horrified and angry, and I'm sure most of your listeners would, if suddenly this very meaningful, intimate conversation between people who have known each other for generations, part of the same family or friends from birth, would suddenly have this conversation broadcast to the world. I don't think it gives us any more meaning. I think it undermines it. It cheapens it.
And that's an interesting point in the whole crux of this discussion and the whole plus or minus factor that you factor into this discourse about social media. This dependence or usage of social media has become such a permanent fixture so quickly. So then to what do you attribute this widespread success and adoption of this very type of thing, this showing our intimate selves to the world? It happened really quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. That's another very, very important question. And I answer this in two ways. The first is perhaps more of a conservative cultural criticism. I describe this as digital narcissism, that we've fallen, just as in Hitchcock's movie, a guy falls in love with a blonde who doesn't really exist. We've fallen in love with ourselves. Human beings have always been, of course, head over heels in love with themselves. The Greeks invented the term narcissism. So it's not as if there was no self-love before the invention of the internet. Christopher Lash, the American cultural critic, wrote about narcissism in a television age in the 1980s. But with social media, we have this climax of narcissism where, because we think we're interesting and important, we're enabled to broadcast to the world endlessly about ourselves. Of course, the reality is that most people aren't interested in what we had for breakfast or what we're wearing or what we're not wearing. But there's another side to this, which I think is a little more interesting in some ways, which is we're living in a profound shift from an industrial age to a knowledge age, a shift from the analog hierarchies of the 20th century in which most of us worked in large organizations to more of a self-employment economy in a knowledge digital age. And these platforms then are essential for us to broadcast ourselves to build our brand. In this new world, in this self-employed, more individualistic economic environment, we need to use these platforms to broadcast ourselves, to promote ourselves. So it's not just cultural, it's also economic.
And speaking of economics, you called data the new oil. Can you expound on that?
Well, unfortunately, it wasn't me. I'm quoting someone else. Everyone's now talking about data as the new oil. You say data, I say data.
Is it finite, like oil?
Well, it's different, but it's the value. I mean, think of Mark Zuckerberg. Why is this 25 or 26-year-old kid who's been working in his startup for 3 or 4 years, why is he now worth $10, $15, $20 billion? Why now is he in the top 50 richest people in the world? Because he's invented a service which acquires our data. Data has more and more value. Google is a very valuable company because it acquires our data. So data is the new oil in the sense that oil drove the industrial economy. Data drives our new digital knowledge economy. And it's no coincidence that scientists and historians of science are now increasingly defining human beings as data. There's an excellent new book called The Information by an excellent writer called James Gleick. I would encourage all your listeners to read it. And he says, we finally realize that we are information. We're defining ourselves according to our DNA. So in the 21st century, data is the new oil in the sense that the people who control that data, whether it's Mark Zuckerberg or Reid Hoffman or the people who run Twitter, are the people who will have the most power and money. Just look at Twitter. Look at the imbalances. It's the people with a few million followers. They're the ones with power. They're the ones whose data is driving this economy.
When you say or make the point, at least, that we are information, that sort of defining characteristic of who we are as people, doesn't it then take us back to the original point of losing that human component? If we're becoming data or becoming numbers or becoming statistics, do we lose that basic carbon-based with a soul type feel of being a human being?
Well, that's the great challenge. A friend of mine just wrote a book about how to remain human in our digital age. We are increasingly defined in our as ones and zeros. According to our appetites. Google now is promising that it's come out with a service that can tell us what we want. So maintaining one's humanness doesn't mean not being data, but it does mean that that there has to be more to us than data. Because if there isn't, we're essentially robots. And it's no coincidence that in this age of data, robots are becoming more and more an important feature of our lives. We have self-driving cars now. We have robots working in factories. The impact of the internet on jobs is catastrophic. More and more people are losing their jobs because of digitalization. So all this is bound up in this vertigin. I can't pronounce it. Whether this the digital vertigo of a knowledge economy in which human beings are being redefined according to this revolutionary technology, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in terms of our self-definition, whether it's in terms of our networks, whether it's in terms of our social relationships.
How is this proliferation of data and proliferation of information and proliferation of experiences affecting the way we think?
Will you expect me to have a thought about that?
Sure.
Well, I think what it does, as I said, is it certainly trivializes thought. It means that we're only able to think in terms of our appetites. In terms of digital vertigo, it means we're less and less able to concentrate on deep things like books, complicated music, or movies. Nicholas Carr, a friend of mine, wrote an excellent book called The Shallows, which argues that in this age of data, we're less and less able to concentrate on things. So in this age of big data, thought itself becomes, I think, a victim or a potential victim. Complicated, deep thinking. But of course, the biggest consequence in our age of data is the way in which companies and governments have more and more power over us. That's what I most fear. That's why I wrote Digital Vertigo. That's why I built it around Hitchcock's movie, which is a movie about voyeurism and surveillance. In our age of big data, we're increasingly being watched. And of course, as not Big Brother, but as a culture of little brothers, we're all watching each other too. So the most troubling aspect, I think, in our age of big data is the way in which we are being watched endlessly and effortlessly, even in democratic governments like the U.S. and the U.K.
Let's look at one of the three central points of the subtitle itself, how the online social revolution is dividing, diminishing, and disorienting us. How is it dividing us, the social media revolution?
Well, I think it's dividing us in the sense that it's creating more and more atomized individuals. The reality of the social, the reality of the internet is, of course, that we are more and more isolated. We sit in front of our devices, our phones, our iPads, our computers, and we try to be social. But the more we do it, the more isolated we become. And in this culture of radical individualism, we're less and less able to build communities, which is why I think many of these networks are not resulting in viable political organizations. Look at the Occupy movement. I'm sympathetic in some ways to its political goals and ambitions. But in the way it was developed, it was built as a platform for individuals to express themselves. So when you go to some of the Occupy sites, it's made up of individuals all telling their own story. I quote the work of a New York University a sociologist called Dalton Conley, who talks about intravigilism in our digital age, in the way in which we no longer have a centered self and we flip from thing to thing. So the more we use social media, the more fragmented we are, both internally and externally, the less able we are to build relationships with others, whether it's political, cultural, or social.
And speaking of which,
and this argument is made by many researchers, from Connolly to an excellent writer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology called Sherry Turkle, who's written a very important book called Alone Together. This isn't just my argument. It's supported by more and more evidence on the research side.
Using recent social movements as an example, you look at the hoodie wearing during the Trayvon Martin protests over his killing and the fact that he had on a hood, and a lot of people put on hoods and got on social media and broadcast it all over the world. You look at the Kony 2012, the protest of Joseph Kony, the Congo rebel leader who was accused of basic just massacring everybody. And you look at the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement. What do you make of the temporary nature and the quick nature of all these movements just coming online gangbusters and then seemingly dissolving? Is it an attention deficit disorder in the social activism realm because of too much information?
Yeah, I think it's the nature of, on Twitter you have something called trending. So we remember Kony 2012. I have a column for CNN and I wrote a piece about that too. It trended massively for a day or two. all anyone was ever talking about was the Kony video, the Kony tweet, the Kony website. And then all of a sudden, everyone forgot it. Now, I can't remember. This is the first time I've heard about Kony for a few weeks. Because of the real-time nature, the trending nature of this culture, we flit from sensationalized event and sensationalized moment to moment. And I think it's increasingly a culture of amnesia where we forget not what happened yesterday or the previous week, but the previous moment, the previous minute. And there's this more and more this appetite for immediacy. People are more easily bored. I think it's very, very problematic in political terms. How can anyone concentrate in the upcoming presidential election in the serious differences in views between Obama and Romney? How are they going to be able to concentrate? And the problem is in political advertising, because of the way this stuff sells and the impact it has, we're going to have an election fought over Twitter through tweets, which will be instantly forgettable, in which each campaign will fight the other campaign through scandal or some other things, which have absolutely no relevance to the political future of this country. So I think you're absolutely right. I think Kony 2012 is a perfect encapsulation of all that's wrong. Also in the way in which it trivialized and simplified Africa, and the way in which it took advantage of kids. I've got a 14-year-old who was in tears when he read about it. He instantly signed up and encouraged me to give whatever it was, the $10 or $15, and then forgot about it. And that's exactly what happened. It was no coincidence that Kony 2012 was driven by adolescence. And unfortunately, in our trending culture, it's a culture which is driven by adolescence one way or the other, either literally or symbolically.
So would you say that this trending activism is one of the byproducts, one of the negative byproducts of the online social revolution?
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's entirely negative. You know, I mean, I have a column for CNN, and I was in Moscow last November, and I reported on the way in which social networks were important in enabling protest against Putin. I think that's a good thing. I think it's very good that these networks were instrumental in the beginnings of the challenges to authoritarian leadership in the Middle East. I'm supportive of Occupy movement in principle, too. So I wouldn't say it's entirely negative. But where I am critical are these utopians who suggested that now we have Twitter and Facebook, we will no longer have authoritarianism. We will no longer have inequality. The people have found a voice. The truth of that is that the people may, in a sense, have found a voice, but they haven't enabled us to figure out viable political movements and organizations, either to authoritarianism or to some of the inequities in our current democratic capitalist system.
And, of course, the counterargument to that is that Kony or Slobodan Milosevic or Putin can all get on and have their own Twitter pages as well and own
Facebook
pages.
And there's
show Joseph Kony fishing or something like that. Joseph Kony just checked in on Foursquare to the Snow & Company to get some ice cream.
Exactly. Well, there's a social and another important writer called Yevgeny Morozov. He's written a book. He teaches at Stanford University. And his argument is that we're all on these networks for sure. But the reality is that the secret police in China and Russia and Iran are on these things too. And they're actually much better at using these networks than we are. And they're very clever at entrapping democratic activists, homosexuals, other people who stand outside the mainstream, and they're actually using this supposedly democratic medium to clamp down. So we need to be very careful to understand that that secret police actually love this stuff. Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, I don't much care for him in many ways, but I thought he made a very important point about Facebook. He said it could have been invented by the CIA. The reality, of course, is the CIA wasn't smart enough to invent it. But that's true. So even in the supposedly democratic West, governments, secret agencies are using this technology to snoop on us. Again, it's Hitchcock's vertigo. In the 20th century, it was fiction. In the 21st century, all that voyeurism and surveillance, unfortunately, is no longer fictional.
Well, to that point, the internet, not the web itself, but the internet was a Department of Defense project before it became mainstream with the browser culture. So there could be something to that.
There could be something, although I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not suggesting that the CIA and the defense people aren't that smart. They're not that smart that they say, oh, how can we figure out a network that will entrap? No one really understood what they were building. But you're right. It is important to note. And one of the interesting things about the internet is that it was built as a coalition between the counterculture and that military defense establishment. There's an excellent book by a Stanford University professor called Fred Turner called From Counterculture to Cyberspace, in which he traces that association between the military-industrial complex and the counterculture and the hippies. So the internet wasn't the origins of the internet was not some sort of democratic platform, democratic foundation. It actually came out of a very peculiar, almost a surreal coalition of the CIA, the military-industrial complex, and the 1960 hippies who rebelled against contemporary conventional American life.
And somewhere along those lines, Al Gore may or may not have invented it.
Yeah, I don't know about Gore. I think he missed his chance, right? Yeah, I mean, the guy who really invented it were, you know, the hippies. They were the ones who understood the social nature of things. And I talk about that in some detail in Digital Vertigo, of this peculiar way in which the counterculture has become mainstream culture in our life. It's not just the internet. It's also reflected in the way in which rebellion has become a kind of orthodoxy. Steve Jobs of Apple, of course, epitomizes this more than anyone else. Think differently. That's the core of the internet. But of course, when think differently becomes the orthodoxy, it makes it actually impossible to really think differently.
Well, we went online in our own social media networks and asked our listeners if they'd ever quit Facebook or thought about quitting Facebook, as our guest Andrew Keene did. Miles writes, yes, outside of social promotion, it's a time suck with no benefit other than feeling less than one half as connected to people as you would in person. And Justin writes, many, many times once I did. By the way, Justin is a techspert for our other program here coming up right after this, Up to Date, and talks about social media and a lot of the other hardware and software trends as well. He's tried many, many times to quit. Once he did, he's currently on there. And Trey writes, I feel Facebook has more positives than negatives. It's all about your attitude towards it, I guess. I meet people that I've never met before that say, oh, I've seen your stuff on Facebook. I like your stuff, man. Keep it up. Plus, it's the number one platform for sharing anything outside of going outside and actually meeting people. Andrew Keene is the author of Digital Vertigo, How the Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. He's our guest today on Central Standard. What do you think about some of these concepts that our listeners have presented about the positives and negatives? Where do we draw balance?
Well, I think what was interesting is that the first two listeners you read out, I think they present Facebook as a kind of addiction. It's as if they were talking about smoking. You know, I've really tried to give up, and I find it hard, and I've given up a few times, and then I've gone back. And I think this social media, in some ways, has become an addiction. It's very addictive, like smoking, like fast food. It feeds, I wouldn't say the bad part of us, but it feeds the addictive side of us. And the more we do it, the more we want to do it. So I think it does require a certain kind of discipline, self-discipline. I'm not suggesting people should actually literally give it up. I don't think that that necessarily makes any sense. I think the challenge is for us to master it rather than it mastering us. So I would encourage listeners who do feel that they're addicted, who do feel that they can't control their impulses, that they have to be on Facebook an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours a day. And unfortunately, there are many people who are on it almost all day, that they need to retain control of their lives. Because their lives are becoming impoverished, is if the only way in which they're defining themselves is how others think of them.
Would you?
Unfortunately, and I think this is true of much of the internet, in many ways, I think Facebook preys on the people who are least able to defend themselves. I think, unfortunately, middle-class parents are very careful about enabling their kids to go online, and they're making sure that they're not on Facebook too much, or that they are being educated in the management of their personal data. In many respects, I think the new digital divide is not between people who are wired and who is not, not between people who are online and not, because everyone now is online. There's 2 billion people, I think the vast majority of Americans, more and more people around the world. The great inequality is the management of our personal data and our ability to master this technology. I think those less well off, those perhaps who don't have the benefit of engaged parents, are the ones who are most vulnerable to addiction and most vulnerable to being corrupted and being taken advantage of by this media.
Andrew, would you say the current culture of information is sort of like what Thomas Paine describes when he says, "What we obtain too easily, we esteem too lightly"? Do you think there's too much information out there and it's too readily available? And because we can get it so easily, because we can log on to Facebook so easily, because we can do a routine search and get a pair of shoes or a suit or naked pictures or whatever so easily, do you think that's one of the reasons for what you call the diminishing returns of this information economy?
Well, I think that's true, although I would also argue that when it comes to reliable and quality information, it's actually harder and harder to find. So you have this ocean of short-term ephemeral content, of trending tweets and Facebook updates, which anyone can have access to, but really valuable information, information that can help you, that will enable you to learn, is harder and harder to get. And as you see paywalls being built by newspapers, you'll find that a tiny elite, I think, of internet users will benefit dramatically from this media. And everyone else, as you say, will be swamped, engulfed, drowned in data. I wouldn't call it information. It's not real information. It's just data.
But we're obviously not going back to any era of privacy. So what is this realm of what's called big data, or big data, however you pronounce it? What is the big data era look like going forward?
Now, writing it off? Are you like the guys in Silicon Valley who are saying that privacy is a relic of a previous age? Reid Hoffman, who forms part of my narrative, who was the founder of LinkedIn, the most influential social media thinker and investor, entrepreneur in the Valley, he says that privacy is for old people. Others, like Sean Parker, say that privacy is like the horse and cart, or gaslighting. It's a legacy of a previous world that we've just grown out of. It's like the village. It's like agricultural society. I don't believe that's the case. I'm not as blasé as you in just writing this thing off. I think that we need to maintain it. It's not just a relic of history. Privacy can't be relativized and said, well, we live now in a public age. You just have to give it up. It's like, you know, it's like things that have gone away. The VCR, other forms of technology now superseded. I don't believe that's the case. I mean, that's the essence of my book, is that being human in the digital age means maintaining an element of privacy, of keeping that dark room, of maintaining our secrecy and mystery. I don't believe it's inevitably finished. If I did, I wouldn't have written the book. I wouldn't be on this show. I would be living publicly myself.
We have more of our listeners chiming in about quitting Facebook. Randy writes, "Do I think about quitting Facebook all the time? It feels so unnatural and unhealthy. I think the only reason I keep it is that everyone seems to be communicating this way primarily these days. So I know quitting would lead to missing out on things. It'd be nice to get people getting back to mostly communicating the old-fashioned way." And Roman writes, "Yes, I do think about quitting Facebook, mainly due to privacy concerns. Facebook history shows that they don't care about people's privacy, and I'm concerned about how my personal information might be used in the future, as well as the fact that there doesn't appear to be a way to completely and permanently delete my information, such as pictures, past posts, etc."
This is a really, really important point that your listeners need to understand.
Exactly.
They need to be very suspicious of networks like Facebook and Google that are free. The reason they're free, the reason at the same time they're free, they make so much money, they're worth billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, is because their core business is advertising, and the more personal data they acquire, the more advertisers are willing to pay because they can learn more and more about us. So we've become the products. That's, again, why I use Hitchcock so centrally in my book. Our story today is a kind of noir. We think we're in charge, but we're not. We're the products. We're the innocent people at the heart of a kind of a new style Hitchcock movie. And your users need to be very, very wary of that, need to understand that companies like Facebook and Google are playing this infinite game of cat and mouse with us, and that we'd be better off. One of my solutions is actually charging for data services. So I like new social media networks, which will force us to say, well, we'll pay $10 a month, but we guarantee that we won't charge your data, that it will never be public. That's the problem with Facebook and Google.
It's interesting that you bring up that point of this false sense of empowerment on the part of users of social media, because to complete what Roman, our listener Roman, wrote in about quitting Facebook, he says, quote, "I'm keeping my account open for now, mainly because it's so convenient to keep in touch with friends. But if Facebook ever crosses the line, I will close my account." Talk about that. That presumption.
Well, how's
if they
Roman
ever cross the line?
Yeah, right. I mean, they cross the line every day. It's not because they're bad people. It's not because Mark Zuckerberg is evil. He's childish. He's trivialized the human condition. He's actually a very smart young man. He's a brilliant young man. He's a sort of one of the great Americans of our age in many ways, like Carnegie was in the 19th century. He's the new kind of robber baron. But whereas the old industrial robber barons were stealing physical stuff from us, he's stealing our data. But I think this idea of users knowing when Facebook crosses the line is very, very problematic. Facebook is continually taking advantage of us. The last scandal this week has been the way in which they have given us Facebook, its users, Facebook email addresses without even telling them.
Wow.
And then there's a scandal, and then they back down, and then it reappears. So that's the problem with Facebook. It's not because they're bad people. It's their business model is flawed. Free is never really free. Much better off paying for stuff. That's one of the great tragedies of the internet, is it's introduced this free business model. Consumers think they're really well off, in which because they have a free search engine like Google or a free network like Facebook. But they're never really free. These are not public services. They're built on acquiring our data and then selling that data one way or the other to advertisers. So if you want to be exploited, use these networks. If you don't, either use networks which focus on privacy or pay for your services.
So, Andrew, you wrote the diagnosis, so to speak, for the current cultural ethos of the online world and the social media revolution. You wrote the diagnosis. What's your prescription for digital vertigo? How do we change our current course or find balance?
I'd say there's four ways. Firstly, I think, and this has been the theme of this actually fantastic conversation, I appreciate the great questions, is we all need to think for ourselves. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, you shouldn't use it on a Friday, or you should only use it 2 hours a day. We all know what it means to be an individual. We all know who we are if we look inside ourselves. And to maintain that, we need to protect ourselves. People need to make that decision and use social media appropriately. Secondly, we need some government involvement. I'm sympathetic of some of the legislation coming out of the EU in terms of making sure that the internet, that we legislate a right to forgetting on the internet. In the US, we have a do not track law now going through Congress. President Obama's been pretty good on this. Thirdly, we need to support a new generation of internet companies who are making privacy the center of their products and businesses. There's a new search engine called DuckDuckGo, the anti-Google. There are many new privacy products. People need to read my book. There's a whole chapter on new services and products. And fourthly, we need to embrace the market and technology. There's a new technology now, for example, being developed in the Netherlands, which will enable the degeneration of data. The biggest problem with the internet at the moment is it hasn't learned how to forget. It's too young. That's not human. Humans, the great quality of human cultures and societies is its ability to forget. So to solve this problem, we need to figure out how the internet learns how to forget, whether it's through technology, new businesses, legislation, our own self-involvement. That's the great challenge in our age of big data.
Our guest is Andrew Keene, author of Digital Vertigo, How Today's Online Social Revolution is Dividing, Diminishing, and Disorienting Us. Andrew Keene, thank you so much for joining us today on Central Standard for what's been an interesting, very interesting conversation.
Wow, this was intense. Thank you. And I hope everyone gets to the chance to read my book. I'm AJ Keene on Twitter if you want to follow me and tell me why I'm wrong. All right.
Irony lives. And speaking of social media, are you a fan of Central Standard on Facebook yet? If not, what's taking you so long? Go ahead and search for us or find the link on KCUR's Facebook page. We're sharing links and articles we enjoy and insight into future programs we have planned. Central Standard is produced by Andrea Salenzi. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.